Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from San Francisco's Financial District. I'm Mark Stoner, your quarterly chair. We also welcome radio listeners from across the nation joining us today for America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. William J. Bennett has become one of America's most important, influential, and respected voices, one of our nation's leading cultural and political thinkers. During the 1980s, Dr. Bennett emerged as one of the nation's leading political figures. He served as President Reagan's Chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, 1981 to 85, and Secretary of Education, 1985 to 88, and President Bush's Drug Czar, 1989 to 1990. During his decade of public service, he earned the reputation as a man of strong, reasoned convictions, who spoke candidly and eloquently on some of the most important issues of our time. Bill Bennett has accomplished a rare feat. Since leaving government, he has achieved an even greater impact on our national political debate. He has written and edited 14 books, including the most recent one released this fall, The Educated Child, A Parent's Guide from Preschool through Eighth Grade. Two of his books rank among the most successful of the decade, The Book of Virtues and The Children's Book of Virtues. The Book of Virtues has been made into an animated series which airs on PBS. Although he is a well-known Republican, Dr. Bennett has consistently reached across party lines in order to pursue important common purpose. He works closely with Democratic Senator Joseph Lieberman on the issues of popular culture and worldwide religious persecution. And Dr. Bennett and former Democratic Governor Mario Cuomo serve as co-chairs of the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. Dr. Bennett is currently a John M. Olin Distinguished Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a co-director of Empower America. Please welcome William Bennett.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's wonderful to be back at the Commonwealth Club, wonderful to be in San Francisco. Someone said we apologize for the bad day, the bad weather in San Francisco. I don't think you have bad days in San Francisco, but it's interesting to hear denizens at least willing to admit that the possibility. The other day, someone introduced me off some of the same notes, pointing out some of the books I had done, and then this cartoon series. But they made a mistake. They said Mr. Bennett has done the Book of Virtues, the Children's Book of Virtues, a book about Bill Clinton. And, I have, but then they went on to say, and these have been made into an animated cartoon series. The thought of my book about Bill Clinton being made into an animated cartoon series is not an entertaining one. I wouldn't suggest it. But I'm not here to talk to you about politics. I'm here to talk to you about education. Let me tell you in my own words a little about myself. I am a professor of philosophy. That's my training. I have a PhD in philosophy. I have a law degree. I'm not a practicing lawyer. I came into government service as Ronald Reagan's chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. That's not the National Endowment for the Arts, I would stress. That's the one with the pictures. It's the National Endowment for the Humanities. I took office about a year after Ronald Reagan was inaugurated. They told Ronald Reagan he had to have a professor of philosophy or history or literature run the endowment, so they began a nationwide search to find a professor of the humanities who had voted for Ronald Reagan. There were three of us in the country, and surprisingly, none of us had tenure. So I was the biggest, and still am, and I got the job. It was a wonderful job. I enjoyed it. Did a lot of work with universities, many universities in this part of the country, and indeed all over the world. Wherever the humanities were involved, wherever there was an international or national conference on the humanities on any subject, American scholars were there. If you had a meeting in Paris, if you had a meeting in China, if you had a meeting anywhere on virtually any subject, the lion's share of the experts were from the United States, a point of some pride, I think, for us, justifiable. My second job was Secretary of Education of the United States. That was the job I enjoyed the most. When I got the job, my wife, who was an elementary school teacher and a special ed teacher, said, don't just stand there and make pronouncements. Find out what you're talking about first. And I said, well, why should I do it differently from anybody else in Washington? And she said, because you're the Secretary of Education. Do your homework. Do your homework first and then make your pronouncements. So we did our homework. I said, well, what do you propose, Elaine? And she said, go teach school. Go teach classes. Go do some retail. And I said, well, I'm the Secretary of Education. I don't do retail. I do wholesale. And she said, daughter of a salesman, if you do good retail, you'll do better wholesale. So off I went. I taught in 115 schools, 3rd grade, 8th grade, 7th grade, 11th grade. And I should tell you that if you're the Secretary of Education or have some position like that and you teach in a class, they'll bring out the local TV cameras sometimes. And as Dan Quayle will tell you, if you make a mistake, you might lead not only the local news but the evening news, the national news that night. Anyway, it was an exciting and bracing experience. I met many teachers. A lot of students, school board members, principals, people I still stay in touch with. It was my reality check, and it's still my reality check. In the preparation of this book, we stayed in touch with an awful lot of these people. My last job, I'll just mention it briefly, was director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, or Drug Czar, which is a ridiculous title, but as Drug Czar, I could refer to my wife as Czarling. And our then little boys as the Czardines. I really actually loved that job. My learning curve was very steep, but it seemed to me the right thing for the government to be doing. I'm a conservative Republican, but I do think government has some very important responsibilities, one of them the protection of its children. Those were the good days for that issue, too. In 1985 to 1991, drug use went down in this country by about 70%, which you would not hear normally. People will tell you there's nothing you can do. You have to surrender. There's no way to combat the drug problem. We had a bipartisan effort. I worked with Joe Biden, Senator Biden, and Charles Rangel and other people. And this country really made a very strong effort and fought back and made a difference. You couldn't turn on TV without seeing ads about drug use. I remember the two eggs in the frying pan. I remember jumping off the diving board into the empty swimming pool. These were very effective. I'm still at that work with Governor Cuomo. He and I are co-chairs of the Partnership for Drug-Free America, and I think some of that public work is still making a difference, though it is not being backed up by an effort in Washington. The president has dropped the ball on this. The Republican Congress has not been forceful either, and that's too bad because it is a crucial issue. If you turn to the students, which we're going to do now by talking about this book, ask children, teenagers, what's the most serious worry you have? What worries you the most? What frightens you the most? It is still drugs by a long shot. And when our children ask us for help and protection against something like that, we should respond and respond positively. They want us. They want us to be more forceful on this issue than we have been. By the way, that same survey, which was in the New York Times, ought to give interesting pause to parents and grandparents, because the thing that came out second, what are you most frightened about, second in the poll, was peer pressure. Kids act as if they take their peers as authoritative, and all they want to do is do what their peers do. But in fact, many of them are quite frightened by what their peers are pressuring them to do. Another suggestion that we need to be the adults in our children's lives, not their buddies, but their parents and grandparents. That's largely what this book is about, The Educated Child. I have participated, as have many Americans, almost everybody in public life, bemoaning the state of American education, saying what we think is wrong with it and what the problems are. And we can talk about that some today. There's plenty wrong with American education. There are some great schools. There are some wonderful teachers. There are some fine students. There are lots of parents who are doing their job. But we're not performing nearly as well as we should. So this book, this big book, this 656-page book, which we do not recommend to you that you read from page 1 to 656, but rather look into it, look through it, pick a page here and there, go to sections that might interest you. But we think this book is if you will, the lighting of the candle, maybe a big torch, maybe a big fire. We hope so, because we think taken the best research, the best common sense, the best advice from our teachers and parents and people we talk to, and put it between the pages of this book. And it is advice. It's advice for parents. The principal audience is parents or anybody who is concerned about the education of a child. And we think we have offered, at least we hope we have offered, state of the art about what it means to educate a child. We say in these pages of this book, if you do this from pre-K through eighth grade, you will get an educated child or something closely proximate there too. The first thing we do, which I have already been surprised to hear reviewers and some of the people I've been interviewed by comment on, is they say, well, so much of this is addressed to the parent rather than the school or the teacher. Well, that makes sense. Parents, after all, are the indispensable teachers. Not every teacher is a parent, but every parent is a teacher, the child's first teacher, and probably, in most cases, the child's crucial teacher. A child can survive a mediocre school, can even survive a poor school, if a parent is there as the backdrop, as the net, making sure that that child proceeds to learn, gains grasp of disciplines and subjects, gains literacy. And, of course, a really attentive parent will do whatever she can within her power to get that child into a better school if that school isn't satisfactory. So there's a lot of advice here to parents. And we're finding out from some of the reaction that although we think most of this is pretty straightforward, pretty commonsensical, that we live in a new age, and to a lot of people, this is news. To say to people, what we have said is to some people news. Some people have commented and said, that's very interesting you say turn off the television. Well, we didn't think that would be particularly news. We thought we ought to say it. But to point out the ways in which television can interfere with learning, that sleep matters, that good breakfast matters, that an attitude toward school, positive attitude toward school matters, turns out to be interesting and new to some folks. We took a lot of our advice to parents from what teachers told us. This is a very pro-teacher book. It's a teacher-friendly book. And we asked teachers, in your perspective, we asked dozens, hundreds of teachers, in your perspective, what would make the schools better? And, you know, virtually unanimously, the teachers said if parents did their job better, we could do our job better. This doesn't say there aren't schools that are doing it wrong and teachers are doing it wrong. Of course there are, and there are some places that are so dismal you wouldn't want to ever send a child to it. But there are lots of people out there in America, in American schools, doing their best, trying to do their best, but they don't feel they're getting the cooperation at home, from home. What we say to parents is if you want to be in a position to complain about American education and to complain about schools and teachers, you have to make sure you're doing your job first, measuring up to your responsibilities. And they are, you know, they do not require a doctoral degree. They do not require huge amounts of time, though they require some time. What they mainly require is setting the right priorities. And so to repeat, it means making sure that homework is done, not to do it for the child, but to make sure that's done. The TV's turned off, person goes to bed at a reasonable hour, gets up in the morning, has breakfast, and goes to school with a good attitude toward learning. Teachers say, believe it or not, give us that, and we will dramatically improve American education. Another point that's very important, and we stress this throughout, is your teaching as a parent doesn't stop when schooling starts. A lot of teachers have told us they sense the attitude that parents believe they can sort of drop their children off at kindergarten or first grade and pick them up in eighth grade, a finished product, you know, with a mortarboard and fluent in Greek and able to do trigonometry and so on. No, you remain part of the, a very important part of the teaching faculty. Again, enforcing the right priorities, setting the right priorities, and supplementing that curriculum of the school. We have 10 principles for parents of educated children on the back of the book. I'll run through them very quickly and then would love to turn to your questions. I've mentioned a couple already. Parents are the first and most important teachers. Your teaching doesn't stop when schooling starts. By the way, let me say here, we have a note up front for single parents, because a lot of people say, well, can a single parent do it? Of course a single parent can do it. Single parents do it all the time. It's harder for a single parent, as many things are harder for a single parent. But you bet, single moms, which is what we're talking about most of the time, can do it and do it all the time. My brother and I were raised by a single mother. We had a grandmother close by. They both stressed the right priorities, and arguably we turned out all right. Arguably, there are people there are people who take issue with that, but some of the people who say that I didn't turn out right think my brother turned out right. So you have to figure it out. Anyway, we're single moms can do this work. It's harder, as is everything else, but this work can be done. The early years build a foundation for all later learning, make it sturdy. That's absolutely right. We have an awful lot in this book about reading. Reading is the critical skill to be read to early, to be read to throughout school, to learn to be an avid reader. If you can get to third grade, if when you get to third grade, you are a good reader and an interested reader and want to read, the odds of your educational success are great. One of the really interesting things about reading is it not only predicts your success as a reader and your ability to do things like study history, it also predicts pretty well your success in subjects like mathematics and science. So reading is critical. The other thing we say in the book, it turns out this is true, although some teenagers wouldn't like to admit it, continue to read to your children through their teenage years. They may resist it and say they don't want, the last thing they want you to do is lie down with them and read a story. But try pushing the point, and you will find, as many parents have told us, that they're actually eager to. They don't want you to tell their friends that you've done that. But they were comforted by your voice at a very early age. Your voice saying once upon a time was the whole world to them, and it gave them a sense of security and comfort, and it engaged that imagination, and it still can. It's a kind of magic. It is a kind of magic that works. And parents should continue to do it. Fourth point, American schools are underperforming. We say then here, we borrow a line from defense policy, trust but verify. American schools are underperforming. You have to know whether your school is seriously underperforming, just underperforming, performing well, or performing exceptionally well. Odds are, if you go to your school and say, how is this school doing? People will tell you, it's doing fine. And your child is doing fine. And, as in Lake Wobegon, 80% of our students are doing fine, or 79% are above average. A doctor, a mischievous doctor who had some time on his hands, collected the statistics from states all around the country and reported that based on state reporting, 92% of American children were scoring above the median, which is very good work if you can get it. I will yield to the professor of mathematics to tell me if this is possible. But this was the sort of good news, happy news kind of thing that we hear all the time. In some ways, the genesis of this book was at a soccer game about 5 years ago with one of our little guys, and I overheard two parents talking, and one said to the other, do you like your school? These are parents from different schools. And they said, yes, we do. Is it a good school? And the mom said, yes, we think so. I mean, they say everything's fine, and we're learning what we should be. We think it's okay, but, you know, we're not sure, and we do have some questions about why little Sandy doesn't seem to know certain things. Well, this book will try to answer that question. I mean, this book will suggest, it does suggest, if your child's in the third grade, fifth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, these are the sorts of things your child should know. Maybe not all of them, maybe not even most of them, but some of them. There are lists in here. We borrow extensively from E.D. Hirsch's core knowledge work, you know, what every third grader should know, what every fourth grader should know, and other work. And we think this is a helpful, parent-friendly kind of way to check on what your child knows. There are stories in this book which may sadly be familiar to parents of a child who had nothing but great grades all the way through eighth grade, or ninth grade, moves on to a high school, you know, a magnet high school with a challenging curriculum, and the child comes home and with very bad reports pointing out that that she can't really do anything. Everything was overinflated in the first school, and she finally hits reality and discovers that all these reports were glowing, but rather hollow in terms of their accuracy. We have this phenomenon in the United States consistently in a lot of our assessments, our international assessments. When we put our kids up against kids from other industrialized nations, we don't do as well as we should. Here's an interesting thing to ponder. We do pretty well, particularly in areas like math and science, at the early grades, third and fourth grade. And as we move along through the eighth grade and 12th grade, our relative standing drops, and that is a distressing thing. There are a number of indicators that we could be doing a lot better. Even our best students tell us in surveys that we could be doing better, that we could be asking for more from them. Point five, learning requires discipline. Discipline requires values. We remind parents here that, the education of character is always going on. I don't have much stock in special courses in ethics or character education in the schools. We can talk about that if you'd like. We remind people that most character is learned the way it's always been learned, through rule, precept, habit, and example. And that if the encouragement of good character is an important thing to a parent or school, as certainly it should be, then there are a couple of simple to describe things to do. If you want your child to be responsible, hold them responsible. If you want your child to persevere, make sure they stay at it. If you want your child to learn the difference between right and wrong and trying to live your life at least as best you can and as best they can in accordance with standards of right and wrong, put them in the presence of people who know the difference between right and wrong and who are trying to live that out. There is nothing in this area like the power, often the quiet power, of example. Sixth point, very simple one, follow your common sense. We're going to get into some big arguments, I know, with some school of education people and some professionals on this one, but we have an axiom in here, and we put it this way. We say, if you're an interested parent and you go to your school and say, what's wrong, and the teacher or counselor or expert tells you a bunch of stuff and you don't understand what they're talking about, you're probably right and they're probably wrong. We think education is so overladen with jargon, with obscurantist terminology. Oftentimes we think it's just stuff that's there in order to hide behind or veil a certain degree of uncertainty or ignorance. There's a lot of what Jeremy Bentham calls nonsense on stilts in the education world, as there are in other areas of human inquiry. We think following your common sense is a very good guide, not always accurate, but follow your judgment, follow your common sense, talk to other parents about things, and we think that's a good bit of advice. Number seven, content matters. What children study determines how well they learn. This, we think, is very true, pretty obvious, we think pretty commonsensical, but an awful lot of educational practice and theory is arrayed against this idea that content matters. A lot of people will tell you the content doesn't matter. What matters is that children learn how to learn, and let them learn on whatever it is. To some extent, we would indulge the idea that if a child has an interest in snakes or coins or the history of trains, certainly indulge that. That's fine, and that should be encouraged. But there are subjects the child must learn in school. This book has a lot in it about English and history and math and science and geography, and we think that what children learn is very, very important. It is important, clearly, as well, to learn how to learn, but we believe that you learn how to learn by learning something. Number eight, television is, by and large, the enemy of a good education. I've been doing TV interviews and saying this as politely as I can, but it's pretty much true. There's remedial history, there's remedial math, there's no such thing as remedial television. You can't get it wrong. You can get it wrong if you want to go on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. You can get those questions wrong, but you can't get the watching of the show wrong. When you have numbers, and I just saw this recent survey talking about the distribution of time in children's lives, and I frankly don't believe the last numbers. We'll have to look at it. But we have a number of years of study that pointing out that the ratio of television watching to outside school reading time is about 20-1, and this is a very bad thing. Is there good television? Of course there's good television, and we talk about some of those bright spots in the book. But by and large, we take a pretty hard line. We believe that virtually anything is better than television. As a father of sons, I'm even prepared to say fighting is better than television. You can learn, you can learn how to take a punch. You can learn how to throw one. You can learn not to fight. You can learn to say I'm sorry afterwards. There are at least some things, more often I've found good things to be learned there than anything. Number nine, education reform is possible. You can change the system. Now, that's bold advice from someone who's been trying to change the system for a long time and hasn't. But we don't mean the entire education system. We mean maybe a little bit of what goes on at your school or in your district. This is not, for the most part, a book about education policy. It's a book about educating your child. But we do suggest to parents, if they are interested in changing the system, that as parents and as citizens, they can act, they can do things. And we cite examples of communities that have changed things and brought things around. And finally, number 10, aim high, expect much, and children will prosper. We think high expectations is a very important thing, expecting much and aiming high. And we believe children will respond to it. I remember when my wife and I decided on our young children that we were going to enforce this no TV during their week rule. They were quite young. We thought there would be a lot of resistance. There was a little bit of resistance, and after that there was none. Once they knew the rules, once they knew what the parameters were, that was it. We said they could go watch TV on Saturday, but, you know, once the habit was broken, during the week, there was less interest, frankly. There was a lot of interest the first Saturday, but after that, there wasn't so much. One final point. People say, well, if the education of our children or the education of America's children isn't so hot, how come America's so hot? Well, the answer to that is this is a great nation. It's the greatest nation in the history of the world. And we give people lots of bites at the apple. A great nation with freedom, with this infrastructure, with this economy, with the generosity of the American people can overcome what I think we have, which is a mediocre educational system. We also give people lots of more opportunities to get educated. You can get a GED degree. 55% of American children go on to college. The Economist magazine called me up and said, you have a perfectly good high school curriculum in America. Just you take 16 years to do it, that's all. They can't talk, by the way. They can't boast from a position of superiority on that score. The workplace provides opportunities for people to learn. The incentive system is so deep in American life and American culture that people who may not have wanted to learn at all when teachers were instructing them, when they go into the workplace and find out that if they can get X skill or Y skill, may pursue that skill in order to get a raise or to get a promotion. Those notions, by the way, ought to be imported into American education. There ought to be more incentives. There ought to be more competition. There ought to be more opportunities for improvement for teachers as well as for students. In any case, this is a very optimistic book. This is a book that says you can do it. We know millions of people who have done it. I'll end with a note, probably an obscure note from philosophy, but as I told you, that's my field. When Immanuel Kant answered David Hume's question, David Hume said, was knowledge possible? Immanuel Kant answered it by saying, we have knowledge, so we prove the possible by the actual. Can you educate a child in America? You bet you can educate a child in America. It's done every day, and it should be done more often. Thank you very much, and welcome your questions.
Thank you, William Bennett, co-author of The Educated Child. At this time, Watson Letch, Commonwealth Club board member, will conduct our question and answer session.
Let me just stand here.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mark Stoner, our quarterly chair. Mr. Bennett, we have a large number of questions. Some are very similar to the ones that you had from Ron Burns this morning just before coming over here, and some are different, as we would expect, and perhaps even better. To begin with, should the Department of Education be abolished?
No, probably not. We don't need it, but we've got it. I don't have a problem with the degree of federal involvement in American education. I think my major problem with the U.S. Department is that people look to Washington for the solutions. But as a country, you'd still want programs for educationally handicapped children. You would still want programs for research and higher education. There are a number of things that the federal government does that are fine. I was asked this question once by George Will when I was Secretary of Education. He did it in a very George Will-like manner. He looked at me and he said, "Must you exist?" And he said, "I mean it institutionally, sir, not personally." No, it doesn't have to exist. Arguably, American children are getting a better education before the U.S. Department of Education. But in terms of spending your time on a worthwhile project, we're not going to get rid of that Department of Education. Republicans need to understand that. When I was named Secretary, Ronald Reagan had to sign a letter to the Senate saying that He was not going to abolish it. We've got it. Let's make the best of it. But let's make it plain that the education of children is much more a local activity.
A number of questions dealing with what does the Secretary of Education actually do? And would you also comment on what you think of the current Secretary of Education's performance? And as you stated just a moment ago, we have a question on whether or not all of the interests in government about adding teachers and really doing things that perhaps local folks ought to be doing. What are your thoughts on these matters?
Well, secretaries of education do their jobs differently. I spent most of my time traveling and visiting schools. That was, again, my wife's advice. I thought it was very good advice. Secretaries of education read reports. They sign documents. They are occasionally asked to lead parades and go to bar mitzvahs and first holy communions and send letters to Eagle Scouts and all those things, which can be well worth doing. I think that in a free country like ours, where the secretary of education does not set the agenda of the country in education, as he doesn't set the curriculum, that the main job of the Secretary of Education is to stimulate a national debate and dialogue in addition to his other statutory responsibilities. Let me tell you the difference. When I visited France, I met the Minister of Education in France, and as we were talking about what was going on, he looked at his watch and he said, "Mr. Bennett, it is 9:10. They are all reading their Racine." That's a centralized country. I mean, if you're the Minister of Education in France, you've really got a job. You decide what they're reading at 9:10. He said, "What are your children doing right now?" I said, I don't know what my kids are doing right now, quite apart from the children in the American system. It's decentralized. Nevertheless, let me tell you one interesting thing. These are interesting questions. I believe we ought to have national standards. And I believe the Secretary of Education should push for national standards. I also think the Secretary of Education shouldn't be beholden or governed by what special interests in his party say or do. I wasn't. Dick Riley's a good guy, but I've never heard him say anything out of dissonance with what the teachers' unions say. And I'd like to hear him say that. We should have national standards in this country. A lot of conservatives don't want national standards because they think it'll mean national tests. I would like national tests, but you will not have national tests in this country anytime soon because, as a friend of mine says, conservatives object to anything with the word national in it, and liberals object to anything with the word tests in it. So we may not end up having either. I forget the third one that you mentioned there. Should we move on?
Let's move on.
Let's move on.
Let's move on. A number of questions about vouchers and charter schools. Is there any evidence that they perform better than other schools? And what about issuing vouchers to parochial schools?
Sure. That's a big, complicated question. Charter schools seems to be the movement of the day. There's been a big debate in the state of California on charter schools and how hard or how easy it should be to get them. The returns that are in are still very early in terms of the success of charter schools. There are some returns on vouchers from the city of Milwaukee and the city of Cleveland. Those are two systems where there are choice. Students use their public money to attend parochial private public schools. Paul Peterson has done the research. He's a professor at Harvard. I refer you to that research. He argues there's much greater parental satisfaction and learning improvements in that system. I would propose the following. I am a very strong advocate of choice. I would propose the following, and here I follow Matt Miller, who is a former Clinton employee, government employee, who wrote an article for Atlantic Magazine. Let me just take a minute to set this up because I think it's very interesting. You may want to have Matt Miller here sometime. He said that in talking to the interests of the public school establishment, the teachers' unions, people said their biggest need was money. We need more money. We need more money. If we had more money, we could get the job done, and we wouldn't have to worry about choice. He said opponents of the establishment, the left, the old left, the new right, lots of inner-city parents, that's the interesting coalition for choice, is conservatives, old leftist intellectuals, and inner-city residents are the people who are for choice. They say give us choice. Miller proposes the following. You take the 3 or 5 or 10 major urban school districts in this country. They're the ones that are in trouble. You increase their funding from Washington by 20% or 50%, 50% increase, so that in D.C. the expenditure per child would go to something like $14,000. Now, I think you ought to be able to do it for 9, but they don't seem to be able to very well. but it would go to $14,000. In exchange for that 50% increase, you give everybody choice. This, it seems, would satisfy everybody. When he presented this, when Miller, who was a liberal Democrat, presented this to the teachers' unions, they said no deal. Miller said, supposing we double your budgets but allow for choice. No. Triple your budgets and allow for choice. No deal. This is not an argument about money. This is an argument about no competition. And I think that's just too wooden-headed, too reactionary a position to take. We're having this intense debate. It's been, you know, it's been rough. I was out here for prop. Got so many props out here. Prop 174, maybe. School choice, and, you know, the vitriol was intense. Let's settle it. I'm prepared to go by the evidence. Let's take, you know, L.A., D.C., and Chicago. Let's voucherize them for 3 years, and let's see if the students learn more or less. If they learn less, I'll give it up. But I don't think they will. I think they'll do better. And this isn't about whether conservatives win or liberals win or teachers' unions win. It's about the children. So in those circumstances where parents are willing to give it a try, let's give it a try and see what works. By all means, let's see what works.
We have a number of questions concerning the measuring of performance by tests and the comparison between tests in this country and other countries. And at the same time, we do much better in other countries in terms of economic competition. So what country should we emulate? And indeed, are these comparisons valid?
That's a good question. I think they are valid. We don't have to go abroad to note problems. We can see, for example, that reading progress, to take one case, we do pretty well in the early grades, as we do in a lot of subjects. But in those middle grades, reading progress slows dramatically. The problem part of the curriculum, I think, is essentially from fourth or fifth grade on through eighth or ninth to 10th grade. That's where things get very soft in America. In other countries, there's an entirely different philosophy. Not entirely tongue-in-cheek, you might say that some of the difference is accounted for by various countries' attitude toward puberty. There are countries like Japan which say, we do not accept the fact of puberty. It doesn't exist, you're going to work harder. Or it does exist, you're going to work harder. And they put on the juice, turn on the steam. There are some places in America where we surrender to puberty. We say, it's junior high school, what do you expect? And if you've been to a middle school lately, been in a building that's filled with nothing but 7th, 8th, and 9th grade people, the building moves. I mean, there is so much energy. There's so much stuff going on. On this puberty point, I was asked when I was secretary, if you could wave a wand and, you know, do one thing to improve American education, what would it be? I said, I would get rid of puberty. That would have, but I wouldn't, not really. I don't want you to think I'm that much of a curmudgeon. I really wouldn't. It brings about some wonderful things. It can also get you into trouble. But it's an attitude toward education. Look at the work of Stevenson, Professor Stevenson at the University of Michigan. Difference in attitude, I think, is probably more important than even the governmental approach. Parents in other countries, in the Asian countries for the most part, when the kids aren't doing well in math, tend to say the children should work harder. American parents, their kids don't do well in math. Their tendency, statistically, it's demonstrable, is to say, I didn't do well in math, Aunt Gladys didn't do well in math, your grandfather didn't do well in math, we don't do well in math, we don't test well, but we're very nice people. And that's an attitude which, over time, begins to make a difference. I think you can make the case that our performance drops either comparatively or in comparison to our own standards as we progress. Why do we do well? Because we're a fabulous country with all sorts of resources. We also do well because we're a nation of immigrants and continue to be. We were talking during lunch, but one very interesting story I can tell you is when I was in the office of Secretary of Education, a very well-known author and lobbyist, author who had turned lobbyist, came to see me with a complaint. And he said, we send he was representing the People's Republic of China, Communist China. And he said, we send about 500 graduate students per year to the United States to do advanced work in physics. About half of them come to Berkeley, as you know, former chancellor, vice chancellor. And he said, wonderful universities, the best in the world. I said, we are very upset because 200 or 250 of them every year decide to defect. He said, what will you do about this? And I said, I'm going to work immediately because we want them all. We, you know, We need them all. They'll be freer here, and they can go to work here. And that is a reason, another reason for success as a country.
How can we attract top people into teaching when the salaries are so low?
Well, I would redo the teaching profession, as I've said a number of times. Take the last point, the success. American universities are the greatest universities in the world. How do we run our universities? Are there things to be learned from the universities that we could apply in the schools? Absolutely. Does every teacher in the university have a class with 23 students or 25.6 students, whatever the California rules are? No. You've got some people at Berkeley who lecture to 300 or 400 people at a time, and it's fabulous. And they could lecture to 5,000 people at a time, and it would be just as fabulous. There are some people who are very good in that sort of setting, and there are other people who are very good in a smaller class setting. Some people are good in both. Differentiate. Understand that that human talent comes in a variety of forms and packages. And the way we do it in elementary and secondary schools, we assume that everybody delivers it the same way and should get the same rewards. They don't. Some people are better than others. Some people are better at different things than others. Look and learn from the university system. Let the foundations and some of the charitable institutions endow chairs in the elementary and secondary schools, as we have endowed chairs at the university level. The greatest teacher I ever saw in my life was Jaime Escalante at Garfield High School in East Los Angeles, California. He's now in Sacramento. It doesn't matter how many calculus students Jaime Escalante has. They're all going to learn from him. And if you can get him on TV, if you can get him in the football game after Stanford Cal having a football game this weekend. Oh, big response. Yeah, all right. He can teach everybody. He can teach everybody there. The other thing is overcome the snobbishness that's built into American education. I have, as you can tell, enormous regard for higher education in America. But we do have a notion in this country that the further along you are in the education of people, the more important you are. That the fewer students you have, the more prestigious you are, until you get to the point that the most prestigious professors have no students at all. They work at institutes of advanced study. While the person who is really making an impact on a child is a first or second grade teacher is down at the bottom of the totem pole. I'll tell you, as a parent, our older son John repeated first grade. We didn't like first grade where he was the first time, so we repeated it. It's fine with him. We had a lot of discussion of it. But the teacher wasn't right in that first grade. The teacher was right in the second first grade. That teacher, Mary Jane Tropia, made more of a difference to John's feeling of comfort at school and his interest in school and his love of school, turned him around from a child who didn't want to, who was a good kid and did his work, who didn't want to go to school, to a child who did want to go to school. Now, what is that worth? What is that worth? You start the proceeds for the chair for Miss Tropia, and we'll be first in line.
I lectured 800 students at once at Berkeley. 300 is a small class. What substantial improvements in teaching methodologies have you seen that might become important in the future?
I don't think there's anything. There's a lot of talk about the new tech stuff and how it can deliver. I don't think it's delivered yet in the way we'd like to see it. We talk a lot in the book about computers and use of computers, calculators, computers, PCs, the information superhighway. For all this, our kids are not doing as well in math as they were in the early 60s, not nearly as well, and not even as well as in the late 60s after we had gone into decline. There's still no substitute for good preparation, knowledge of subject matter. We think teachers need to be freer to teach the way they want to teach. We think they should be held less to a modus operandi of teaching, but measured for results. One of the things about choice and vouchers, everybody tends to think of it as the voucher debate about teachers and teachers' unions. But one aspect of it, which is very interesting, and this can occur under the charter system too, which is the teachers, I'm thinking about the people who are supposed to be expert in the methodology, can set up their own schools. Now, this has been done here in this area. There's a school, is it in Oakland or Berkeley? I'm not sure. It was set up entirely by teachers. They designed it. They designed the whole school. Interesting to see what a school would look like if teachers had set it up. Not many bells, not many interruptions, as you might know. Less paper, as you might imagine, and more teaching. We need to, experiment more. We need to give them more freedom. Again, think of the university model as a better model than the one we've got. We also now have something called homeschooling, which is growing leaps and bounds. I said when homeschooling started, the first kids who get into Berkeley, Stanford, and Harvard, see, I'm being neutral on this game, Harvard will lose no matter what happens. The first kids who get into those universities who are homeschoolers will validate the homeschooling movement and it will grow. Homeschoolers, for the most part, are not what some people think, which is, you know, folks in the hills, you know, with crayons sitting behind closed curtains, you know, drawing pictures for their kids. Very sophisticated people on the internet comparing notes with other parents, and the success rate for homeschoolers is very high. The reason I mention this is the walls are going to break down. We're going to see more of a fluid system of education where you're going to see a lot of work done at home. Maybe some of the hours at school will not be spent at school but will be spent somewhere else. You're going to see, as you've read in the papers, a lot of the big players, a lot of the big investors, a lot of the big business people are going to get involved in elementary and secondary education. Using the internet, all sorts of things are possible. So let's keep an open mind on it.
Do you think the internet is damaging the morality of young people, and would you regulate it?
Well, surely sometimes it is. I don't think there's any question about that. I think it's very hard to regulate, but we do have the state of the art. There's technology that can answer the technology's problems. It's an amazing thing in a free society. You can introduce correctives to excesses. There are internet filter systems are available. I was asked to join a board of one, and I did because it seemed to me to be a good product. I say that so there's full disclosure here. I'm not going to be commercial for it. But there are a number of companies that can provide internet service with filters that seem to be pretty effective, pretty good. Schools, I think, should look into this, and parents should look into that. One piece of advice for parents we put in the book is if you got the internet, don't have it tucked away in the corner of the child's room. Have it in a more or less public place, a family room, or some place that you can scan at it as you walk by. It's a powerful instrument, and it is, like many powerful instruments, or an instrument for good and for ill. You don't want to deny your child the opportunity for educational advantage because of your fear of things on the internet. You need to respond to that fear, which is not irrational. It is a rational fear by dealing with it. And there is technology as well as parental good sense and prudence that can deal with it. There are a lot of kids who are on the internet too much. We run the risk of turning the internet into the latest television or a Game Boy or other such thing.
Standardized test scores such as the SAT have been heavily criticized as inappropriate measures of a child's education and intelligence. What is your opinion of the future role of these standardized tests?
I think the SAT has a future. It's been criticized, but you know, every year there's a barrage of criticism of the SAT, but it holds up. It actually is a pretty good test in terms of predicting student performance. It predicts pretty accurately and has held up pretty well. It shouldn't be the only measure, but it is a measure. People need to be very careful when they think about things like grading systems and doing away with grades, and we address that in this book. Because if you do away with grades and real assessment of student progress, then you are going to be pretty much dependent on one kind of test, and that's not a good thing. Let me mention here the ways in which tests can be very liberating and very very much a cause for celebration rather than gloom. The forenamed Jaime Escalante, the great teacher from East L.A., Garfield, when he produced his group of kids from the barrio who took the advanced placement test and got fours in calculus, a couple of fives in calculus, the people at Princeton looked at the results, looked at the kids, and said, these are poor Latino kids from the barrio. They must have been cheating. This was a nice assumption on their part. I mean, it was a terrible thing, but that was their immediate assumption. So they made these kids take the test again, or a different test. The second time, more of the kids got high grades. More of them got fives. Well, if Jaime Escalante had not had the test and was celebrating his 21 students in calculus, a lot of people would have said, this is just a feel-good exercise, nice guy, self-esteem, here we go again. but they had fives in advanced placement in calculus. And there's something irreducible about a five in the advanced placement in calculus. You get it or you don't. And they got it, and there wasn't anybody who could take it away from them.
By and large, the outcome of an SAT test can be correlated directly with zip code, and it is well known that children from poor parents do not do as well as children from affluent parents. Do you think that we can really make a reform in our educational system until we have greater parity amongst parents in the economic sector?
Well, there is a strong correlation, not in anything like a 100% correlation, but there's a strong correlation to zip code and SAT score, as there is to zip code and virtually anything else. First of all, money helps. Money helps everything. Second, there's a chicken-egg thing. Are people in those zip codes because they were dropped out of the sky, or are people in those zip codes because they maybe have worked harder, are smarter, present themselves at school and do their lessons? How do you achieve educational equity? Well, one answer I just gave, Jaime Escalante. I mean, he proved it. There were people who told Escalante that the kids in Garfield would not be able to do the calculus. Let me tell the story. Read Jay Matthews' biography. It's a wonderful story. He's one of the great heroes of our time. He comes to Garfield High School in East L.A. and says, I want to teach these kids calculus. And he is told that he can't do this because the kids aren't capable of it. They're not smart enough. They won't succeed. He is told this not by the kids, but by the parents. Not by the parents, but by people at the school. One parent says to him, one counselor says to him, Mr. Escalante, you can't ask these kids to start the study of calculus. They'll fail. This will lower their self-esteem. This will be bad for them. It's dangerous for them. I asked Escalante what he said to that, and he said, I told them I am an immigrant from Bolivia. I haven't been in this country very long, but it seems to me if you're Latino growing up in East L.A. in the barrio, there are a lot of things that are dangerous to you. Calculus is not one of them. Now, this guy is a one-man force for upward mobility. But here's an interesting story. I'm sitting at my desk as Secretary of Education. This is what the Secretary of Education should do, back to that earlier question. I read this story by Jay Matthews, an L.A. writer for the Washington Post, and it says this man has got these results teaching calculus. I get on the plane and I fly out here, right? Wouldn't you? I mean, if you run the National Cancer Institute and somebody's got the cure at Berkeley, you go out and take a look, don't you? I go into the school. I'm sitting there with the principal, a great supporter of Escalante's. The superintendent comes in, and I said, this Escalante must be something. And the guy says, the superintendent says, I don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? You haven't been here? You've read the story? He said, well, I haven't been here because he's very controversial. I said, who is he controversial with? He says, he's controversial with the teachers who aren't getting these results. Well... So we go through that for a while. I mean, this is a very, very interesting business. He was finally let go from that school because he refused to yield to the grievances of a number of his colleagues in the teachers' union because he had 100 kids in his class. He was teaching calculus to 100 kids in violation of some union agreement, and so they let him go. Greatest teacher I have ever seen, they let him go. So he's now saving kids up in Sacramento. But the larger point is this. These kids, were engaging in a lot of bad behaviors. As they told Jaime, there's a lot of fighting, a lot of getting girls pregnant, a lot of drinking. But they were also, readily in need of education for someone to take them in hand, firm hand, and show them the right way. One other incident, because it stays in my mind. This is in Matthew's book. Second day of calculus class, a boy gets up and starts to walk out after Escalante's done some stuff at the blackboard. And Escalante says, where are you going? And the boy says, I'm going to go see my girlfriend. Escalante says, fine, go see your girlfriend. But on the way, go stop in woodworking. And the boy says, why? And he says, so you can learn how to make a shoeshine kit. So when the Anglo businessmen come through LAX airport, you can shine their shoes for a dollar. The boy's back arches. He says, I don't want to shine Anglo shoes for a dollar. He says, then sit down, you dope, and study calculus. Now, this is a teacher. This is a teacher. This would not be probably condoned in a lot of schools of education, but this may be the first man this boy has met in his life was willing to look him in the eye and not say, gee, you know, how can I help you and, you know, what can I do for you, but say, you know, you're a dope. Sit down and learn not to be a dope. When Escalante's graduates went on, I know a number went to Berkeley, some came back and taught. And he would bring some of the students who went on and who went on to careers in aerospace industry otherwise, and he would bring them back to the class, and he would say, now bring your sports car with you. And the guy would say, I don't have a sports car. He said, get a sports car. Bring it. So, bring your beautiful girlfriend. I don't have a beautiful. Find a beautiful girlfriend. Anyway, he's a little bit of a showman in this guy, but he does teach calculus. And they would come, and they would talk, and they'd go out of the parking lot. He'd bring the kids to the window, and the guy would drive off in the sports car with the girlfriend whom he hired from someplace or borrowed. And Escalante would say, and he was a dope. You are much smarter than he is. You can do much better in your life. Now, that's a great teacher. We can do it. There are the Black Knights in Harlem. There are Escalante's kids. There are Marva Collins's kids. We can do it.
Well, we still have quite a few questions, but our time is running out. So our last question, if George Bush the Younger wins the election, do you wish to have or would you accept a cabinet position?
No, I don't think so. I very much like what I'm doing. I had three jobs in Washington, and that was they were great, and I was honored to serve for two men for whom I had the highest respect, who treated me well, treated themselves well, treated the country well. It was an honor to do it. I like very much doing what I'm doing. I'm an old professor of philosophy, and the writing of books is very, very encouraging to me, and it's been very good to me. So I will continue to do that. I am at present advising George Bush on education and other issues. I'm also advising John McCain. I've advised Elizabeth Dole some, too. I'm happy to advise any Democrats if they'd like my advice. They haven't called, but the issues are the same, and they don't come with political subtitles. So this is about educating our children. All I would say, I guess, in closing, with the political year approaching, and this will be a big issue in the presidential debates, and I hope people press the candidates on their views. What we should do, it seems to me, is in the spirit of that article I recommended, we should do what works, whatever the ideology says, whatever ideological objections people may have. There is a state of the art in American education. It is not a black box. We know what works. We know what's effective. We know the difference between schools that work and schools that don't. A lot of that's in this book. We should use that, apply that, take all the political wind out of the sails and just stick to set our course by what works and what has a proven record. And I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to William Bennett, co-chair of the Educated Child, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on radio. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is adjourned.